Okay, Bezos Hashem, we are going to continue our review of Klipas Shah Bitachon Perek Gimel. As the chapters we discussed last week, this is the chapter where most of the fundamental principles are laid out. So we've been seeing here that he says there are five things to have in place in order to really have your fully rounded Bitachon. The first of the five was internalizing the seven premises of Bitachon, as we sent out last night.
Thank you, boss.
Shkach for the reminder. That was number one. Number two, we also discussed last week, is the understanding. One of the prompts toward Bitachon is the understanding that Hashem is actually watching to see, do you trust me? And it's not just about Hashem reassuring us, but Hashem is saying, I want you to rely on me, and I'm checking to see if you do. I want to see that. It's a part of our relationship. That was number two. Number three, and this is what we're up to now. Hagdama Ashlishis. Sheyached elikov b'mitchoy. This is a theme that the Chovas HaLevavos keeps stressing. Your reliance on Hashem should be exclusive. Don't make Hashem share your reliance with anyone else. I rely on Hashem and also on so-and-so, including myself. Meaning a person, you see, he elaborates earlier, that sometimes a person's bitachon can take the form of, have this person taken care of me? Or sometimes it can take the form of, I have my own talents to rely on. And in case all else fails, then I have to fall back on Hashem. So we'll discuss that a little more, Mitzvah Hashem. But this he's saying is a very important point. You want to shift your trust, your reliance from anyone else, including yourself, over to Hashem. How does that work exactly? What happens if a person wakes up in the morning and he says, how am I going to have parnas at the end of the month? And he says, all right, I have a job. How am I going to do the job? All right, I know how to do it. I've been doing it for a while. So, 1 minute. You're supposed to say, no. Don't believe in that. Only Hashem, how does that work exactly? I've been doing this job for 10 years, and I've been making that money every month, and I trust that I know how to do the job. So, what do you mean, don't rely on that? Let's see. Let's see. Okay. Because the Maaseh, if you have others that you're trusting on, that you're relying on, that will take away your reliance on Hashem. First of all, for the simple mathematical reason that if your reliance is split, then it's not 100%. That's just basic math. But besides that, it's also in the sense that, let's say, this fellow has so and so who is supporting him. He also has to rely on Hashem. But the more material the source is, the more likely I'm going to rely on it. Meaning, let's say it like this. Let's say it like this. That person has a job. Baruch Hashem has a job, has an employer that he gets along with very well, and he has a very comfortable setup. The employer is very good to him, respects his work, gives him a generous salary with nice perks. Okay, so now this person is sitting and thinking, where am I going to have parnasa next month? Answer is my employer. So here the Chovas HaLevavos says, no, then you're not relying on Hashem. Now this gets a little complicated, but let's try to talk it out properly. The way to approach it is, why do I have such a comfortable setup now? Not because this employer is here, but because Hashem decided that now at this stage of life, I want you to have that comfortable setup. The employer is the means that Hashem chose. He's not the cause of it. Had it been something else, had the employer not been here, it would have come through some other means. You would have had this setup. You would have had this setup. This is a little bit of a tough concept to wrap our heads around, but this is really how the Chovas HaLevavos is trying to condition us, if you will.
Okay, so let's take reliance a little bit further. So you have this comfortable setup, and now you want to take out a loan because you want to help your children. So can you rely on Hashem that he's going to continue this comfortable setup? You know, or can you not? I mean, like,
So
you go into debt in reliance on Hashem.
let's take a step back. Let's take a step back. Before the person has a comfortable setup, this is an important point to bring it out. Before the person has a comfortable setup, right now he has no job. And the question is, where am I going to have parnasa from? So do you say I'm going to apply for a job? I'm going to apply for an interview, or do you say I'm going to rely on Hashem? What's that?
You could apply for a job and
And
rely on
not
Hashem
rely on
and
Hashem?
rely on Hashem and
Oh,
they'll find
so
you'll get
the
the
answer
job.
keeps being both. That's right. That's the answer. You do both. It's not one or the other. You do both. But here's the question. This is really the key question. But you know what? As far as your question goes, in other words, what we're saying is, Hashem says, and this is really what's coming up later at great length in this chapter, Hashem says, I want you to go through the motions of a responsible, reasonable effort toward your parnasa, and then rely on me to work it out. Right? And that is the whole challenge of Ishtadlus, as we're going to see later at great length. But Be'etzem, the mindset that's expected of you is make a responsible assessment, make responsible efforts, and then leave it up to Hashem. Really, that will be the same answer to your question also. Should I take out a loan for something that I don't have right now? And the answer is, Hashem will step in after you make that responsible assessment. So when your question is, should I take a loan? First, a responsible assessment. Hashem wants me to go through those motions. A responsible assessment. What will the loan mean? Do I have the means of paying it back? It's a very interesting discussion in the Mishneh Berurah, actually. There's one area where we're told just dump it on Hashem when it comes to Tzitzis Shabbos. Right? Spending for Shabbos, the actual lashon is levo alayv. You take a loan and I'll take care of it. So here the Mishneh Berurah has a very interesting discussion. He says, many places can come and say that means that it's a stretch. You can see a reasonable way of paying back the loan, but it's a stretch. So Hashem says, do it. But if you have absolutely no idea where you're going to pay it back from, then no. The Mishneh Berurah says, at the very least, you have to inform the guy you're borrowing from. I'm doing this for Shabbos. I have no idea how I'm going to pay it back. You have to tell the person that. Then he could do it. Whatever the case is, so it's really the same question. Any issue that has to do with gashmius, etc., you have to make a reasonable, responsible assessment. And then you say, if I made a reasonable assessment and I'm acting accordingly, I now operate with the understanding that Hashem will do what he sees fit. Now let's take that case where a person does have the comfortable job. The person says, my comfortable job continues, I'll be able to pay it back within 3 years. But who knows? So here we say, no, if a reasonable assessment, a responsible assessment now says that, no, this is something I can do. And again, it's not frivolous. It's not for the person purpose of going on some crazy vacation, but it's for the purpose of some real legitimate need. Then you say, I'm allowed to take that step. What happens if in 2 months, chas v'shalom, the person finds himself without a job? Now, what do I do about the debt? Here we say, okay, Hashem allowed me to take that step. What's going to be further? His plan for me. But the point that we're coming back to now is that it's that challenge of working with material sources of support, whether it's your own abilities, whether it's other people who are helping care for you, or with the understanding that they're not really the cause. The cause is Hashem. And if it wouldn't be them, it would be somebody else. The only reason I have this parnosa now is not because this company exists. That's not why. It's because Hashem decided I should have a comfortable setup. If it wasn't this, it would be something else.
This is my question. When I think I have the job, it shows my lack of bitachon. It feels like if I think I'm relying on Hashem, then I know any second it could be taken away from me. You know, like this table wouldn't be here if Hashem didn't will it to exist in the next second. So instead of feeling more secure, it makes me feel like, well, I have a job today, but Hashem could decide tomorrow to take it away. It makes me feel less secure
Oh, so this is a
relaxing.
point that people, this is a very real question of the way we work emotionally. And that is that I would like to see the stability of normal material reality. So we can answer the question from two directions. We can answer the question from two directions. Number one is that if you would sit down and start doing research that I don't recommend, right? I'm not saying don't do this, but the person who has that kind, you see people who have that kind of thinking and the kind of personality, they mamish, their lives are terrible. But to start reading up on all the people who lost their jobs in a moment, okay? And as you read enough stories, the person becomes sure that that's what's going to happen to me next week, right? Michael Jakobson, he's told me about, he got a call from somebody who went into medical school, really started learning about all the different things that could go wrong, and just the person became all ice mensch. Oh, every medical, so what do you, what's the point that we're making? You feel secure, maybe not really in an educated way, but you feel secure because there's a certain reality. So, you know, all we're saying is take that sense of security and say, see if you can shift it over to Hashem and say, Hashem has been taking care of me up till now. I'm putting myself into his hands. I'm putting myself into his hands. And yes, it is a call, it's a challenge, it's not an easy avodah. But that is the call. That is the call. In fact, to a large extent, that was the nisayon of the Jews in the Midbar. Well, I should put it a little differently. The Jews in the Midbar lived in a reality where there was no food for tomorrow. Right? You got the food every morning for that day. Also more than that, meaning that they relied on Hashem spoon feeding it to them on a day-to-day basis. The Gemara elsewhere doesn't say it in this context, but says that that is a very hard way to live. In fact, it refers to it as a certain klala. Now, the antidote to that klala is bitachon. But without bitachon, that's a very tough way to live, right? So, well, that was the reality. But it was even more than that. There was no material, there was nothing to rely on materially in the Midbar. The Midbar that they went through is areas that could not sustain human life. It says elsewhere that these were places that people didn't travel through. It was just the conditions were too harsh, both in terms of the elements and in terms of the dangers that they were exposed to. And they were experiencing how they're being held by Hashem. And without that, there is no existence. That they are not air covered, etc. But also more than that, anytime they slipped, Hashem let go. This was the reality that they were living with. They had to hold themselves up to a standard in order to have that. If they slipped, there was an attack of snakes, there was an attack of an enemy, there was an epidemic. These were all just the natural reality of the area. It was just that, okay, well, let go. And it was a tough reality to live with. And therefore, what happened? They were looking forward to getting into Eretz Yisrael. This is Rabbi Victor Miller's take on the whole Ma'aseh Meraglim. It's worth hearing this. They were looking forward to getting in Eretz Yisrael, into Eretz Yisrael, because then they'll be back on solid ground. Right? They'll be back on solid ground. Like reality is predictable, it's material, it's we'll continue to be under that sham, but let's know that there's the grapevine in the backyard, right? And that there's wheat growing from the ground, and we live in stone houses without the other. So they were looking forward to getting to Eretz Yisrael.
Where is the people coming in?
What's that?
Where is the people
Oh,
coming
that's all part of the answer. That's all part of what Hashem wants. So then what happened? The Meraglim went to Eretz Yisrael. They came back. What they report? They basically reported like this. They said, Rabbi Yisai, you thought that when we go into Eretz Yisrael, we're going to be living on solid ground? I have news for you. In Eretz Yisrael, it's not going to be any different. It's going to be the same reality. It's an Eretz Yisrael. We're going to be in that same state of a slip and boom because we don't really have a natural means of existing. There can be all those strong enemies around us, and it's a land that with the harsh elements, etc. Eretz Yisrael, etc., etc. Rabotzai, we're not going to get back there. So what should we do? You know, maybe they're just better off in Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim wasn't fun. But you know what advantage Mitzrayim did have? But it was predictable. It was normal life. It was olam hazeh, right? You knew where your food came from. You knew what you were up against, right? And it wasn't like the sense of if you're not constantly treading water at the highest level intensity, you sink. Very intense existence. So the Meraglim was like a breaking point. We're going to continue this in Eretz Yisrael. Ah, we can't do this. So what did Hashem say? Hashem said, if so, you're not the generation I can take in. A generation that already has a sense of material stability is not going to work for me. You can't be the ones to settle Eretz Yisrael. Who can? People who were born into a reality where your only stability is Hashem. Who was that? That was the next door. The door that went out of Mitzrayim was a very great door, but they did not successfully move from a sense of normal, stable reality to I'm moving my sense of stability completely into Hashem's hands. They couldn't do it. It was a very tall order. They couldn't do it. So Hashem said, no, in Eretz Yisrael, I need people who live that way. I need people with the Midbar mentality. People who feel that my sense of stability is only Hashem. I don't have it, it's not from the fig trees and the vineyards, and it's not from the stone houses, etc. So I need them to be able to move into Eretz Yisrael and see in the stone houses Ananei HaKoven. And see in the grapes and in the fig trees, I need them to see Man. And that's what does this tie into which time of the year? That's the mitzvah of Sukkot. The mitzvah of Sukkot is Hashem is saying, you're moving into Eretz Yisrael, make sure to hold on to the Midbar mentality. The mentality of flimsy huts, because our protection is not stone. Our protection is Hashem, etc. That's why the Sukkot is reliving the existence of the Ananei HaKoven in that sense. And this is all that, to be able to live in the material world and see this is Hashem taking care of me. So what do you say? Maybe Hashem is going to let me down. So first of all, it comes back to, that's why he says you have to have a lot of premises in place before you can get there. Bechina, having really experienced quite how much Hashem took care of you. And if you say, I don't know, I had a lot of problems in my life. Then we tell you better go back to Shara Bechina and apply yourself to it. And then, so you say, but still, yes, he took a lot of care of me, but who knows when? Okay, so we just come back and tell you, well, look at the material world. Who knows when? Any area of material life, with all the predictability, you have that same element of who knows when. So wouldn't you rather know that you're in his hands and that you can rest assured that only what's best for you is happening? Right? We said that about the Chofetz Chaim. This is from the other angle. I think we said the story of the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim was once talking about this inyan. Chofetz Chaim was talking about the lack of reliability on Gashmis. So some wealthy fellow, it's a wise guy, said to the Chofetz Chaim, he said, you know, you talk about this could fail, that could fail, but I have assets invested all around the world in so many diverse things. I just can't really conceive that everything would collapse at once. Right? That's what he told the Chofetz Chaim. Now, even if the whole area of Europe falls, I still have investments in Africa. Like what? The Chofetz Chaim said, you know what? It's not realistic that everything could be taken away from you at once, but it is realistic that you could be taken away from everything you have at once. That's realistic. It's all the same thing. It's on the contrary, learning, it's a tough balance. We don't want to focus on the lack of stability of the material world just to bring ourselves to a place of just feeling completely lost. But we do want to bring ourselves to a place of moving away from the sense of reliability in the material world to the sense of, yes, I've been fine up till now. Why? Not because of the stability of my job, but because of the stability Hashem has been providing me with. And we told this story not recently. This is actually not a recent repetition. It's a repetition from a while ago. But we told this story, the Shlov's mashal about the people who were at sea. The people on a long sea voyage, and they still had a long time until they were going to get to their destination. And sea is just it's an uncomfortable existence. They passed by a little island, and they decided, you know what? Let's just enjoy a day or a half a day, whatever it is, a few hours on solid land. So we'll stop. We're going to make a little detour, a little delay, and we're going to spend a few hours or a day on solid land, and then we'll get back and continue our voyage. So they all piled off onto this island very happily and decided, okay, they're going to spend the day here. Lunchtime came and decided they're going to make a campfire for lunch. Now, the truth is that that island was a whale.
Yes, it was
Remember the
one
Marshall?
of
Okay,
back
remember it was a whale. It was a
of
whale. Now, yeah, I think we
the
said it this way other times. Whales have this quirk. If you light fires on their back, they don't like it.
one.
So what does a whale do if you light a fire on its back? It dives underwater, it flips over, right? So that's what happened. The whale suddenly went under, and all these people suddenly found themselves flailing, and they managed to get back, huffing and puffing and spitting water. They managed to get back to the ship and to pull themselves back up onto the ship. So then they said, you know, what looked like stability was very not. And what we thought was instable, that was really our place of stability. So that's basically the mashal that the Shlag gives. Move your sense of stability away from just the material course of things. Move it over to Hashem. I think we said this mashal when Corona first hit, and when we really saw how all the givens could just be pulled out from under you. Okay. Question.
Yeah, I don't see a regarding from the words any sense of gratitude.
We don't see that. Oh, so here you're really pulling us into a very hush of a subject that we can talk about for hours. But I will just say this briefly. The Dvar Midbar, we when you read the Torah, you read the Parshas of the Torah, you don't see the full picture. You only see a bunch of complainers who are running into problem time after time, right? Now we have to bear in mind, we're reading the Parshas one after the next. I remember I was once at a Sheva Brachos. Okay, and somebody, it says in the Torah that they went for 3 days and they didn't get fine water and they started complaining. I was once at a Sheva Brachos. I remember somebody was speaking. He's leaning on a bottle of Coke on one hand and there's a bottle of water on the other hand. Okay, and he says, how could it be that Klal Yisrael would complain about not having water? How could it be? Must be that there's more depth to it. The Chazal say that the water is Torah, but he's saying it just has to be because Klal Yisrael, they just saw Yetzias Mitzrayim, and they just came out of it, they saw Kriyas Yamsa, so complaining about water. Must be more depth to it. You know what the more depth is? The more depth is that when you read it in the half a breath by Yalchus Shleishis, I mean, they went 3 days and they didn't find water. And you say, already they're complaining? It took me a second to read it. Why are they complaining already? How long is 3 days?
Well,
And how long is 3 days if you're thirsty and you have a whole family of little kids?
and you're in
And you're in the desert?
the desert.
You have to say, 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute. What did I just read? 3 days. That means that for 24 hours with all their kids, they didn't complain. Isn't that amazing? And then for 48 hours, 2 days, no water, nobody complained. The Rebbe Avigdor Miller trained us to read. You have to read between the lines and the words. It took 3 days before they started complaining. A nation of how many people with families, with little kids? It's an amazing illustration of the godless of Klal Yisrael. Now, that's just one example, but the truth is, this is really true. We see they angered me 10 times. Hashem says, they angered me 10 times. Time after time, there's problems. We read the Parshas of Shavua, Bamidbar, Parsha after Parsha, right? Parsha after Parsha. But over how long of a period were those Parshas? 40 years. A nation of 3 million people. Why do I say 3 million? 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60. So you have to add double it with the women of that age, right? So it's 1.2 million. And then you have to add the older people and the younger people. So it's around, you'll grant me about 3 million, even if we'll call it 2 million. For 40 years, and there's 10 such incidents, that's an average of 1 in 4 years. That's not a bad track record. That's not a bad track record. Why is the Torah expressed it so negatively? This we've discussed. This we've discussed. Hashem was pushing Klal Yisrael for very high standards, and the job of the Navi was give it to them over the head. Find the faults and blow them up. That's the lashon of the Kuzari. He says about the egel. That's chet sheigdilu aleihem lemaalasam. It's a chet that was magnified because of their greatness. We're not going to get into that whole thing now, even though it's actually Parsha Shavua. But you know, okay, we're not going to get into it now.
It's all the nation that they saw were coming out of the planet. How long did it take until they received? How long did that last?
Oh, so that's a whole discussion. You know what? Should we do that? Should we talk about the eagle now? I don't know. Let's talk about the eagle now. Just in order to bring out the point. The point is, and I'm making this, Kuzari talks about this, and Rav Avigdor Miller expounded on this at length, that actually, if you're capable of getting behind the lines, the Dor HaMidbar was one of the greatest Doris we ever had, and one of the Doris that was closest to Hashem that we ever had. We never again had such a reality afterwards. And it was Dafka there, they were put through the toughest training, and Moshe Rabbeinu was the tough commander. It's at the end, note that at the end of the Dor HaMidbar, Hashem gives his feedback, but keeps it secret. Parshas Balak, where Bilam gives all those effusive brachas. It's the one parsha in the Torah since Parshas Shmos that the Bnei Yisrael were completely unaware of. Hashem showered them with effusive compliments, but he doesn't want them knowing it. He wants it to be on record for future Doris, but they shouldn't hear it because their chinuch. How does Bilam's nevuah add up with everything Moshe is saying the whole time? Moshe is slamming them over the head time after time, and Bilam is saying Hashem sees nothing wrong with his people. He's in love with them. How do you add the two together? Answer is Moshe was the mechanech. He wasn't the assessor. He was the mechanech. Bilam was Rav Hashem saying, but I wanted to go on record. I'm very happy with what I made out of my people. So now, what actually happened at the eagle? Let's do this briefly. What actually happened at the eagle? Again, that's my excuse. It's Parshas Shavua. The Kuzari and the Rambam, when you put the two together, you see a whole picture emerging. First of all, let me just ask you a question. What they say when the eagle came out of the fire? They said, Mitzrayim. This is the God that took you out of Mitzrayim. If they meant that literally, then they can't be held accountable for anything. They have to be put into a psychiatric ward, and that's all. You can't hold them. They went out of Mitzrayim. It's just math, right? They went out of Mitzrayim how long ago? Almost 2 months ago? And here's an egg that was created now, took them out of Mitzrayim. How does that work? Nuts. Obviously, it wasn't literal. They weren't, they, even if you say they were bad, they weren't stupid. They weren't that stupid, right? What was going on there was something much deeper. So first of all, let's just talk about the quantities. The Kuzari and the Ramban bring this out. How many people were actually executed for the crime afterwards when they went around and rendered judgment? What's that? A lot less than that. 3,000 people. 3,000 people. That is 0.5%. 0.5% of the people. That's number one. And that's already one principle that it's important to know for all of Tanakh, that when you see accusations leveled against the people, they're said in a very general way, and it sounds like it's everybody, but actually it would be expressed that way even if it was only a handful of people. That was how the Navi operated. The Navi was giving it to them over their head. We see many examples of this where we actually know the numbers. In many cases, you don't know the numbers, you just hear, what a terrible nation you are. Look what happened. Look at these crimes that are being done all the time. It says about the Midbar. Then the Midbar, the Navi says, they exceedingly were Mechallel Shabbos. How many incidents of Chillul Shabbos were there in the Midbar? 1.5. What do I mean by 1.5? You have the Mekoshesh Eitzim, that was proper Chillul Shabbos, and an attempt to be Mechallel Shabbos, it didn't work. What happened? They went out to pick the man. They were told not to go out. They went out and there was no man there. It was an incident and a half of Chillul Shabbos. Hashem says, that's much too much. Chilul. Why? Because he knows quite how perfect he can make his people. What happened at the eagle? So first of all, that's just as far as the numbers go. And the Kuzari also brings down, if it was that terrible, the next morning the man fell. Let's remember that. What they eat the next morning? They ate man. The Nanei HaKavod didn't go away. So what actually happened there? It's a little bit fine, but we'll try to bring it out. He says it was not avodah zarah in the simple sense of the word. What they were trying to do with the eagle was something that we actually do, meaning we know that Hashem is completely aphysical, right? No goof. Yet, as human beings, we need physical means of connecting. And therefore, how does Hashem accommodate that? Hashem says, I'm going to designate a place physical place where I'm going to intensify my presence. You can know that my presence is more intensely there, even though we know Hashem is everywhere. But Kaislam Aravi, right? A shul, the makam of Shechina. How do we in turn relate to that place with a lot of reverence, a lot of coven? You being mechabed stones. Mechabed Shechina, you have to go with coven toward a shul. You being mechabed stones? That's paganism. How can you be mechabed a shul? How can you be mechabed the Kaislam? The answer is that we're not being mechabed, this is how the Gemara puts it. We're saying that since we associate Hashem with this place, we act with reverence toward that place. Okay, but there's a very fine line here. We are not worshiping the place, chas v'shalom. We're not even being mechabed the stones. We're being mechabed the fact that Hashem is expressed, manifesting his presence in that place. And that's why we find in the Midbar also the expression, vayira kvod Hashem el kol. It says that when they saw the Anan come down, they would bow. When they saw the Esh come down, they would bow. Were they bowing down to fire? Is Hashem fire, chas v'shalom? What were they bowing to? They were bowing at the fact that Hashem says, when you see the Esh, you know I'm there. The Esh was a representation of Hashem's presence. Everyone with me on this? This is a fine point. Please speak up if you're not following, because it's a fine point. Let's not get this wrong. The Esh was a representation of Hashem's presence. And therefore, they bow when they saw it because they knew Hashem was there. And that's the pshat in our reverence toward shuls, our reverence toward the kaisel, our reverence toward other things, shebekdusha. And you know what? It's also the pshat in our reverence toward another Jew. You see another Jew, he's keeping Torah mitzvahs, you know that the Shechina is there. And that's why you relate reverently. The din to be mechabed another Jew is not just an issue of ben adam l'chaver. It's an issue of ben adam l'makom also. A Jew is a carrier of the Shechina. But coming back to our subject, what was the epitome of this concept? The Kruvim. Hashem said, make an Aron with Kruvim, and I will address you from there. And therefore, they related to the Kruvim with utmost reverence. And when the non-Jews came in afterwards, they took it completely wrong. They took it at very face value. We went in, these people always talked about like yeah, Shemayim and a physical, and we came into their holiest place, and what do we find? A golden statue. Okay, but Hashem said, this is how I'm going to connect it. I put that there, and my presence will be manifest there. But certainly we weren't worshiping the Kruvim. Now, let's take a step back. This is before there was a Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu was their a connection to Hashem. Right? He went up, didn't come back down. As far as they thought, he was gone. He didn't make it. Now they're all left, lost in the wilderness. What do we do now? How do we connect? So they looked for something that they can designate, as we do as a shul, that, okay, this will be, we're going to establish this as the makam of Shechina. And now we'll look toward it as our place of Hashem's presence. So why did they do it in the form of an ox? So it's actually very amazing. If you look in the Ramban says, you know why? They were trying to, and Rabbi Gamliel adds a piece to this, they were trying to make it as close as possible. We know that the Merkava, the heavenly chariot, has four wheels. I don't know what this means. Don't ask me afterwards. But one wheel has the face of a human, Yaakov Avinu, lion, Nesher, and the ox.
Okay. I thought
that was
the
Merkava. What's that? I thought that was the Merkava. It says the Merkava. Exactly what the different terms connote, I don't know. But the Merkava has those four wheels, okay? So Bavik Davila says they Davka avoided the Tzura of the Adam because that would get too problematic in terms of mistakes that it could cause. They chose one of the other tzuras of the Galkei because they wanted to connect to Hashem, to the Merkava Shel Mala. They chose the Shor, chose the Shor. Why? The Ramban says because each of these different the Ari and the Nesha and the Shor and the Adam all reflect different midas of Hashem, And the Ramban, again, I can't explain this. This is the Ramban working with Kabbalah. He says that the meat of the shor is what rules in the desert. The meat of the shor that rules in the desert. They wanted to line it up against the meat of Hashem that's actually dealing with them. To line it up with that. And therefore, they actually did a shor. And the whole point was, their intention was exactly what Hashem later told them with the Kruvim, because he hadn't told it to them yet. Okay? And they said, this is going to be our base. This is going to be our focus for serving Hashem. What's that? It's the place of an ox. An ox. The eagle is on the ox. So they took it as one of the symbols of Hashem's Merkava, and that's what they wanted to use to basically to take the place of Moshe. Up till then, Moshe was their means of connecting to Hashem. There were other things. Like we said, there was the Damud Eish, Damud Anan. These were expressions of the Shekhinah. They said, we want to set this up that this should be for us the expression of Hashem's presence. And what was wrong with it? But that's all it was. That's it. Hashem said, don't make any images. I mean, how can you make a Kruvim then? Hashem said, make a Kruvim. So Hashem said, don't make any images. You made an image, you meant for it to represent me, you meant to connect to me through it. Boom! He came down with the full harshness of the Chet HaEgel. And then shortly after that told them, make a Kruvim. Which was mamish the same idea, the difference being that this was divinely dictated and that wasn't, and it went against the rule, don't make any images. And that comes under the general heading of Avodah Zarah, even though it was a much more subtle element of Avodah Zarah. This was their means of connecting to Hashem. Hashem said no. And that's the full severity of the Chet HaEgel. Is that? That's what it is. So this is just to bring out how, and this was all part of the training. They were so new to this. They said, "Well, Hashem, we just heard this. Don't make an image. We're lost. We're trying to connect to you." Hashem said, "I'm raising you to very, very high levels now. There's no leeway given, no leeway given, no slack given. There's going to be a very harsh response, and what will the result of that be? You're going to hold yourselves up to higher standards. It sounds harsh, but wait till you see what I can make out of you through this process." That's what it was. It was a very tough, old-fashioned chinuch system. Not something that would work today. And you know what? That's part of the reason we don't have Nevi'im today. Part of the reason. It's a serious point. It's not a joke. We would not be able to live with Nevi'im. Imagine if someone comes to shul. What do rabbis get when they say something a little bit, right? Okay? Imagine if someone comes to shul and the Navi turns around from his place at the Mizrach and yells at him, "Why did you murder last night in front of everybody?" Okay, what actually happened? He embarrassed his wife. He embarrassed his wife at home in front of the kids. Okay, and he yells at him, "Murderer!" In the beginning, what happened? The Bnei Yisrael, they lowered their heads and they pushed themselves to higher heights. At the end, they resented it. They persecuted them. They just didn't want to hear them. So Hashem said, "Okay, fine. We'll move them off the scene, onto the next stage of history." So all of the castigations, Moshe was the Av HaNevi'im. He was the father of the Nevi'im, which meant that he epitomized that he was a tough leader. And that's why you see that Klal Yisrael responded more emotionally to Aaron's death than to Moshe's death, because Aaron was the one who was just there to give them shalom, give them warmth. Moshe Rabbeinu was the tough father. So that's the beginning of the answer to the question. It was a tangent, but you know what? It's Parsha Shavua, a worthwhile tangent. Agutavah. Mechim to you.
Thank you.
Mechim to you.